Hey, everybody, this is Greg Gutfeld. This is The One. My next guest, if I went through all of his achievements, we wouldn't have any time left for the interview because this guy is, in my mind, a living legend. I'm talking about Professor Thomas Sowell. If you know who he is, I'll briefly explain if you don't. He's an American economist. He's a social theorist. He's a political philosopher. He's an author of many books. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. I'm just honored to have him here. His new book, which we're going to talk about, is called Discrimination and Disparities. It came out in March. It is packed with so much evidence and statistics. It's got it's 123 pages, but it's like 500 pages of brain food. If you read this book, I'm not kidding, you will never lose another argument over any kind of controversial discrimination issue. You name it, he's got the facts in here. Hello, Professor. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
First of all, I'll try to explain your book, and then you tell me if I'm correct. Basically, it looks at discrimination and the common explanations for discrimination, and points out how incorrect they are. And then you go on to point out the variables that are often ignored that might explain disparities. Does that make sense?
It does. I think I would put it that the idea that in the absence of discrimination, or for other people, genetic differences, there would tend to be equal or similar outcomes for various groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the fundamental misunderstanding of people about disparities,
mm-hmm.
that there are prerequisites for outcomes, and if there are a number of prerequisites, which they are from most meaningful outcomes,
mm-hmm.
Then you're not going to have anything like a random distribution of outcomes because there's so many things that have to come together.
Right, right. And when you explain, you know, these disparities, you talk about prerequisites. One of the ones that I thought was so incredible that nobody talks about is the impact of being first born, which seems to have a bigger impact than anything racial, correct?
Well, it has a major impact. There's mm-hmm. no two ways about it. And in all sorts of contexts, that is in terms of IQ tests, in terms of going on to do postgraduate work, in terms of honors, in terms of astronauts, you just name it. It matters.
Mm-hmm. It's like the majority of astronauts are first born. And I guess the implication – and it leads to a greater implication, I think, from that you mentioned in your book. It's about undivided attention.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that in writing that, I touched on my own life.
Mm-hmm.
Because had my parents lived out a normal life, I would have been the sixth child.
Wow.
As it was, because they died young,
mm-hmm.
I was adopted in infancy into a family where I was the only child in a family of four adults.
Wow. And that, you know, and so the implication, as we look at now in 2018 and some of the issues that we have, the idea of undivided attention, I mean, it plays such a huge role, because if you look at single parent households and the fatherlessness that we've witnessed, that may play a bigger role than anything, right? The lack of attention.
It may, and a lot of data, not only in the United States but in Britain as well, that fatherless children have a terrible time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of many things over which we have no control, but socially we should have some control in the sense that people need to understand that those children need a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I mean, it pains me when I'm in some public place and I see a child trying to get its mother's attention, and she really doesn't want to be bothered,
right.
You know? I mean, you bring him into the world, you should be bothered.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is interesting how the left primarily is incredibly brave in finding causes for behaviors and bad things that are happening, but they will not address that. Is there a reason why the most obvious elephant in the room is not addressed?
Oh, I guess it's not. There's no political mileage in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fundamental notion of the left is that they can pinpoint the source of inequalities and go out. They localize evils
mm-hmm.
that are not local. You know, they say if you get rid of, as Marx would have said, you know, you get rid of the capitalists, then we've got the problem solved. Or others have, you get rid of this group, you get rid of that group. But in point of fact, there are so many things out there to prevent outcomes from being the same that that's not going to ever work.
And so instead you have, especially in the media, a hyper focus on race. And that, and what that does is it prevents them from seeing the facts right in front of them. And I'm thinking primarily of some of the research that you presented in your book about speeding and how there was a period of time in the media was focusing on how blacks are more often stopped for speeding. And that the implication is because they're black. But you bring up such an obvious point, and it's a point that you brought up regarding speeding, but also differences between Asian Americans and Mexican Americans. It's age, right?
Absolutely. Just the mere fact that different groups are have different median ages. I think most people are unaware, for example, that Japanese Americans have a median age of in their late 40s. Mexican Americans have median age in their mid 20s. Well, you know, there are lots of jobs out there where you're going to need 10 years of experience and or education. And very few people who are 20 in the middle in their mid-20s have that 10 years.
Right.
Whereas in some group that's older, a lot of people have that.
Yeah, and it's like – and so you're if there's a two-decade difference in median age, you're less likely to find Asian Americans probably working the counter at McDonald's as opposed to Mexican Americans, and that's not a racial thing.
Absolutely, the thing that gets me, Japanese Americans, because they have such a high median age, I don't know of a single Japanese American Major League Baseball player. Now, there are people of Japanese ancestry playing in Major League and being stars, every one of whom, to my knowledge, is from Japan.
Right. Yeah.
Not Japanese Americans.
And the and to the point about the speeding is that it's just young people tend to speed more than older people. So if the median age of African Americans is that much younger, you are going to have more speeding individuals in that group.
That's true, but there are other differences as well. But the main thing is this is one of those few things that you can check empirically.
Right.
And so people have looked at, you know, the sample sizes of 40,000 speeders of motorists on the New Jersey Turnpike, and when they turn the radar guns on them and the cameras, it turns out that black Americans speed at a greater rate than do white Americans. Whatever the reasons are, and there may be many, one of which is simply age. The fact of the matter is, it's something that could be checked.
Yeah.
But the painful thing is that once they see a difference in outcomes, immediately they feel they have the problem solved as discrimination.
Right. You know, the other point that you bring up, when people look at a group of people lagging behind another group of people, the point that you make so clearly is that this time lag, it's not a permanent thing. If you look at the Scots, Jews, the British, the Jews were not prominent in, I guess, arts and science until they were. So
yes,
there's a lot of movement going on.
Oh, yes, and especially if you look at civilizations. You know, the Romans and the Greeks were centuries ahead of the Britons at one time. And then in the 19th century, the British lead the whole world into the Industrial Revolution. But a lot of things had to happen in between.
Yeah. That point you made about China, you know, China, there was a great stat in there. 57 million Chinese who are abroad produced as much wealth as a billion Chinese in China. And the fact was a crucial, and you talk about prerequisites, they made a crucial mistake that that China felt that the outside world wasn't really worth it, right?
So they, yes, in the 15th century.
Yeah. And so they decided, hey, we're not going to explore anymore. And it was that prerequisite that they removed that allowed all these other groups of people to surpass them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but they were number one in the world at one time.
Yeah. And then they retired. It's like they actually said, I kind of respected when I was reading that. It was like they were so well ahead and they looked around the world and they go, you know what? We've done enough. You also talk in the book a lot about the unintended consequences of policies, government policies. And I was blown away when you were talking about what life was like before minimum wage laws and how similar the wages were for young whites and young black teenagers.
And the unemployment rate.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, there was in 1948, which is where that series of data began, there was no significant difference between black and white teenagers' unemployment. And both of them had unemployment rates that were a fraction of what we've been seeing for the last several decades.
Right.
And the reason was simply that even though the minimum wage law was passed in 1938, and it was left unchanged for 10 years, and those were 10 years of runaway inflation. So those numbers became absolutely irrelevant. It was the same as if there were no minimum wage law.
Yeah. You know, I realized I made an error when I said wages. I meant the unemployment rates. I'm glad you – and also the labor force participation, which we're seeing problems with now. You also – another unintended consequence that you bring up is asking about criminal background – like a criminal background check.
Yeah.
If you remove a criminal background check, you tend to hire fewer blacks. Is that
absolutely. Mm-hmm. They've done study on this. Mm-hmm. And the employers who give criminal background checks to all job applicants hire more young blacks than the employers who don't.
Right.
And there's a simple reason that in the absence of an actual check, all the employer knows is that there are a lot of young blacks with criminal backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he avoids that problem by avoiding hiring young black males. Well, once you have a business where, for some reason or other, that it's really necessary to give criminal background checks to everybody, then they hire more blacks because they know now which blacks do in fact have a criminal background and which ones don't.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. All of this goes back to the point that you make. Probably one of the most harmful things that a human thinks is to do something. Like they see something, and before they read, they just decide to do something. And almost always what they do is the worst prescription, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The desire to do something is whenever I hear the phrase, it just makes me cringe. Because, no, you have to stop and think and find out what the facts are. Then you do something.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's like nobody has time for that. That's actually really hard to do. I had to reprogram myself when I was younger as an emotional teenager and then a liberal. I had to teach myself because nobody else taught me that about reading, reading before you actually express a belief. You know, find out if you're right first.
Yes, I mean, I'm. It's very painful for me to watch the current things now, where all these young people are out there saying all sorts of things, which betray the fact that they do not know what the facts are.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that you can make it on, clever rhetoric and vehemence. That's the way to make decisions. Usually people who have to take care of themselves and, you know, pay their own cost of living and so forth, learn the hard way that you really do have to stop and think.
Yeah. And the especially after this dramatic gun march on Saturday, people are upset if you hold two thoughts in your head. One, it's nice to see this march, but number two, you should be able to challenge the most outspoken activists on their facts. But if you do that, the media paints you as somehow mean and inhuman if you actually come armed with, you know, you're actually respecting the person by challenging their point of view.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think too many of our universities have given up on that, and they gave up a long time ago.
You know, another when discussing inequality, we keep hearing about income, and this is we talk about this a lot on my show, The Five, and it drives me crazy because whenever they talk about income, or income brackets, what they always leave out, and I think it's one of the sins of omission that you talk about, the key variable of turnover, right?
Yes.
Drives me nuts.
Well, you know, you'll hear things like, you know, the top four people with the top 400 income over some span of time have gotten X percent of all the income in the country and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And what they don't understand is that there's more than 400 people in the top 400.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, shortly after this book went to press, the Internal Revenue Service published data covering the top 400 income earners over a span of 23 years. Do you know how many people were in the top 400 during those years? 4,584.
Mm-hmm.
So you're attributing to 400 people what was actually earned by 4,584,
yeah.
Which means that you're distorting the distribution of income by more than 10 times.
Mm-hmm. And if you if you're a producer or a writer or an anchor and you see that statistic, it's just like that's going to kill my storyline, my narrative, so just leave it out because it's too complicated, even though it's correct.
Yes, yes. Well, except unfortunately, I doubt if most of the people who say the kind of things that are popular now, mm-hmm. I doubt if they even check the Internal Revenue Service
right.
data.
Mm-hmm. No, there's so many good things in this book, and I have like 15 pages of notes. But I want to go to some bigger things that you bring up, and towards the end of the book, you make this point, which I think is about identity politics in general. Is the worst thing you can do is to punish the present day individual for sins of the dead, because that inevitably it helps no one.
Yes, except for people who are race hustlers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really important point. And the other big – you have this – I'm looking for these notes. It was interesting. The two biggest calamities, I guess, in the previous century were Nazi Germany and communism, and they both resulted in the deaths of, you know, perhaps 100 million or more people.
Yeah.
And you kind of – what they did was they utilized the idea of a not level playing field. And they made themselves – Hitler made himself and communism, they made themselves the solution to the not level playing field. Is that kind of true?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you expressed it that way, because there seems to be an implicit assumption that the playing field would be level,
mm-hmm.
if it weren't for particular villains – whom you can remove from office or dispose of in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think David Landis said it best. He said, the world has never been a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we were a species of angels, mm-hmm. the world would still not be a level playing
right.
field. I mean, geography is different. History is different. There are innumerable influences. The more influences there are and combinations and permutations, the chances that they will all work out the same way for one group after another is just staggering.
Mm-hmm. And what Hitler did was he looked at inequality and he blamed the Jews, or he blamed genetics, he blamed the Jews, and USSR blamed it on
capitalism,
the idea of exploitation, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like, I don't know, it feels like we're in the age now where identity politics is going over the same ground that had been gone before.
It has.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that the particular group that's looked at favorably varies over time, but that's just a matter of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost like teenage fads.
Yeah.
Most people are unaware that back in the early 20th century, 100 years ago, the progressives were the biggest supporters of the idea of genetic determinism,
mm-hmm.
and of eugenics, and even of suggesting that in one way or another, people who are inferior should not be allowed to reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And now at the other end of that same century, they're saying it's all due to discrimination. I mean, this desire to find some one key factor that explains everything,
mm-hmm.
it's just pervasive. And the particular factor chosen varies over time. It varies from one part of the political spectrum to another, but it's the same fallacy.
Yes, and then the big issue is when the government is – one demands the government to enact solutions, and there is no political cost tied to those who enact these solutions. They don't have any consequential feedback. So it's unlike the competitive market. If the competitive market tries to solve something and fails, it's hurt, it's damaged. But if the government tries to enact a solution that fails, there's no cost to them.
Absolutely. I think of the some years ago when Coca-Cola decided to change the flavor, and they'd done all this market research and so on. But the fact of the matter is that the people who purchase their product like the other flavor better.
Yeah.
And they had no choice.
Yes.
To scramble and go back to the other flavor.
Exactly. Coke had, and then they rebranded it as Coke Classic. I have to wrap it up because I know you're busy. How would you grade Donald Trump so far? What's your honest take on how things are going?
Oh my gosh. I guess incomplete is the one thing. I was recently someone sent me a video of Donald Trump in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that man was far more mature and balanced and whatnot in his 30s? And how many men are more mature in their 30s than in their 70s?
Yes.
And I think that he's done better than I would have expected, and better than a lot of other people would have expected.
Right.
But if you extrapolate from that, is he on a downward trend? Only time will tell.
Yeah, you know, my theory is that at a certain age, there were a number of things that he stopped caring about and didn't give a damn, and now he only cares about one thing, and that is to the security and the country, that the country survives and the country, like, if you listen to him, I don't think he cares anymore about what people think. And now at 71, it's just, I'm going to make sure America's the greatest. And so in a weird way, that's why his behavior, I think, might have devolved. Does that make sense at all?
I don't know, but I hope you're right, whatever the outcome may be.
Yes. I'm trying to put a rosy picture on it.
Well, I'm a born pessimist, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's, by the way, pessimists are what make the world go around, because nothing ever gets done. Optimists don't do anything because everything's great, you know?
So yes.
They don't do anything. Professor, I loved your book, but all your books are great, and I urge every listener to pick up. It's Discrimination and Disparities. It's like 130 pages, but it's got about like 600 pages of information in it, and it's a breeze to read. And I wish we could clone you, Professor, and have 1,000 of you.
Oh my goodness! Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Right, but you too.